My name is Gary Butterfield, he, him.
My name is Kay Ross, she, her.
And you're listening to Watch Out for Fireballs. It is our monthly dispatch episode. It's usually a Games Club podcast, but now it's a Q&A and topics and announcement episode.
Where nothing is as it seems.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Everything is backward. Everything is upside down with Carmen mm-hmm. Liguzio.
Yeah. It is September. Hard to believe. Hey, Portland Retro Games Expo is next month. If you're making last-minute plans. We're going to be there. I don't think that our slot is picked yet. Yep. So we'll have more to communicate about that when it comes.
At the show.
Yep.
We'll have more to communicate with that in the program.
Yeah.
If you go. We have been confirmed to do it, but it's putting on a convention is hard.
Yes.
Yeah. We got Q&A stuff and everything, and then your responses to September's games. Mm-hmm. I'm going to go ahead and just get started here with Guy. Guy says, just wondering if you played any video game adaptations of movies, etc., that actually rate. I've asked about Mad Max before and recently played RoboCop Rogue City and was surprised to find I had a whale of a time. Would be interested in to hear your thoughts on successes and failures for these games and what makes a video game adaptation actually good.
Yeah. It depends on how loose the adaptation can be. I think because it's like, I don't know, does Batman Arkham City count as an adaptation? That is a game replay as an established character in a variation of that world, but it is not a direct, you know, pull from something. But I guess neither is RoboCop Rogue City, nor is that Mad Max game. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Like adapting a character is kind of different, you know, than adapting a movie. Like adapting a movie is harder because you have to hit those plot beats.
Yeah.
You know, and it's trickier. It's interesting. Like, I don't think what makes a good adaptation is any different than what makes a good game.
Right.
You know, I was thinking about this, like the Batman Arkham formula works in other properties mm-hmm. just fine. Like the tone and everything, the reimagining of the Batman characters to be real edgy and dark and Christopher mm-hmm. Nolan-y is real fun in those games.
Yeah.
But it's not a movie or anything. It's just Batman. Mm-hmm. You know, if it had to hit the points of The Dark Knight, that'd be annoying.
Yeah.
You know, you'd be taking situations that are not well suited to games and adapting them into gameplay, you know, mm-hmm. and then I think about stuff like DuckTales or like classic, you know, or the Spider-Man 2 game, things like that. They'd mm-hmm. be good if they weren't the movie as well.
Yeah.
You know, they're just like good games. I feel like there's not actually the thing that makes a good video game adaptation is how good of a video game it is. It's not mm-hmm. really how good of an adaptation is. Like the closer you do adapting, like generally you do worse.
Mm-hmm.
I think.
Yeah. I mean, just because they're different mediums, you make different decisions about what to focus on.
Yeah. Even in good ones, like I think about that Riddick game.
Like yeah.
that gets a lot of sugar for being a better than average adaptation. The worst parts of that were things that I was doing from the movie. Or that like felt like movie things.
Yeah, because that's a prequel, I think. That's how Riddick gets his eyes.
Yeah, his super eyes, his very mild superpower.
Mm-hmm. So then you think about stuff that like that captures the feel. Like, I don't know, I have so many problems with the game, but like Alien Isolation is an amazing adaptation, right?
Yeah. It's rare that it actually tries to adapt. Usually it's just a good game, and that's how it works, I would say.
Yeah. Good game first.
Yeah.
Yeah. Doug writes, recently I saw a gaming tattoo in the wild. The person had the Assassin's Creed logo, specifically the pirate version from Black Flag. If you had to pick one, that's probably the way to go. It made me wonder, what is the best game-related ink that you've come across? Bonus points for worst as well. All the best.
I don't know. You see a lot of gaming tattoos at conventions.
Yeah.
they're okay. It's a little dorky to me in a way that, like, I thought about getting it before. I'm not saying I'm above it, but yeah, it's a little bit like, you know, like a rap song about video games to me a little bit. Like, there's something a little bit like dorky about it to me.
Yeah. Like, I think that it would have to have personal meaning outside of just being, I really enjoy this property, you know,
or be very funny. You know,
like, yeah, of course. No,
like, seriously, yeah, like, sorry. Like a funny one is fine. You know, like a funny tattoo is a good idea to me. But it have to, like, imagining somebody who cares enough about Assassin's Creed Black Flag enough to get a tattoo is wild to me.
It's like when you see people with, like, wearing merch, or like there are a bunch of these bumper stickers around me I've seen, but like the N7 logo from Mass Effect. Yeah,
I've seen, like, an N7 tattoo. Like,
yeah, same.
Yeah. Yeah. It's like a bumper sticker, but even more intense. It reminds me of, like, people going to the bookstore and buying the fine art of Gears of War 4. You know, that, like, gigantic coffee table tome.
Yeah, yeah.
You know? And it's just like, huh. Like, that is just an appreciation I don't have. Uh-huh. You know? Yeah.
The art book from BioWare's Anthem.
Yeah. finally it can be told, the art from Anthem.
Yeah.
You know? Real ass shit. Uh-huh. You know, that gets made. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I for me, it's like, I haven't seen any of them that I've been like, that's a really cool fucking tattoo. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it's something that, like, I like somebody will have something like a Shy Guy, like a simple iconic thing.
Yeah.
That's cool. That looks nice. Mm-hmm. You know, and because of, like, the way that gaming jokes work, a lot of times these that are funny, like, a lot of times it's, you know, it's the Pip-Boy plowing somebody or something like that. Like, it's really not that funny.
Right. Yeah.
You know, yeah. So generally, yeah, not super into it.
Yeah.
You know, there's a time where I considered it. I thought about getting a Dark Sign tattoo before.
I thought about the Dark Sign one. Yeah.
Yeah. Like, getting something that is something the character would have, mm-hmm. you know, from the thing, like, it would be on their body is kind of appealing to me, but I'm glad I never did.
Yeah, we talked about, like, the humanity sprite you know, before. Yeah, I don't know. I think that, sorry, I'm looking at a very terrible tattoo of Detective Pikachu holding a knife.
Sure.
I think the more you can recognize that it is from a video game, the worse it is going to be.
Yeah.
Like, you get the Bloodborne curse sign tattoo and people just think you're a Nazi. But also, it's just
that's a tricky thing runes. Too.
Yeah.
Like, anything that's just kind of an icon is a little bit tricky at this point. This isn't like gamer shame. Like, I like video games and stuff. It's just like, tattoos are weird. Mm-hmm. You know, I think tattoos are really cool. I have a bunch of tattoos.
You have the dud tattoo.
I have the dud. Most of my tattoos are jokes. Mm-hmm. Not all of them, but most of them are kind of jokes, you know, or something I thought was funny. At the time, I have a couple other ones I plan on getting that are slightly more meaningful to me, but just very personal. Like, I take the same approach to tattoos as I do to, like, lyrics, where I don't want to just say the thing.
Right.
You know, there's something about me that resists that.
Yeah.
And just, like, I love Fallout, but just getting a big Fallout tattoo would feel weird to me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I love Dark Souls, but it would feel weird to me just to get a big, like, Dark Souls tattoo.
Yeah.
For me, it is only video games. I love video games, but it's just video games.
Yes.
No. Fran says, "Hey, you two, I recently started playing Darkest Dungeon for the first time, and I freaking love it. One of my favorite things about it is that now I can listen to your podcast, Gary's Duckfeed Presents, and the WAF that you did, as well as Gary's old Let's Plays on YouTube, with a much greater context and understanding of the game's intricate systems. Because I was hungry for more Dark Dung content to listen to while I'm working and not playing it, I listened to an old critique video by Joseph Anderson. He hated it. While I understood where his negative criticisms were coming from, some of his, to me, extremely bad takes seem kind of the Joker-fied to me, especially by the end, when he smugly concludes that Darkest Dungeon is essentially Cookie Clicker. I've listened to other more recent critiques by Joseph Anderson and enjoyed them quite a bit. If he were to do another video on it now, I hope he would have better takes on the game, even if he still didn't like it. My question is, what games have you done podcast or spoken publicly about in the past that you personally think you'd have different thoughts on if you were able to play them today? Love you too, and thank you for all you do. Thanks, Fran.
Thank you. Two things before we get to the question. If you have Dark Dung, go see a doctor.
There's a whole range of dung that's kind of good. Dude, I'm sure I brought this up on a show before, but it was real funny. I was talking to Derek, and we were talking about urine color.
Okay.
You know, not just like apropos out of nothing, but like he had found a chart, and it was like, dark urine to light urine. Like, obviously, you're dehydrated if you're dark urine. Yeah. But it was like, if urine is too light or too dark, consult a doctor.
Right.
And he sent me a text with that image, and it just said, "Hello, 911, my urine is too hydrated." And it was like, I have clear urine. What do I do? You know, very funny. Like, drink less water. Take a big spoonful of salt.
Just wait. Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't know. If it was perfectly clear, that would be a problem. I don't know.
I rock a clear with some frequency. Like, I have to drink a lot of water because of various medications I'm on.
Perfectly clear?
Clear.
Okay.
I haven't done like an A/B test.
Okay.
You know, like I'm still peeing into a toilet.
Okay.
You know, so I'm you know, it's right up next to the white porcelain and stuff, but like pretty close to like rocking water. Like, it's pretty sick. I always feel good when I've done that. Like, it feels like getting a good grade at toilet. A thing that is both normal to want and possible to achieve.
Like, both of them is the thing.
Yeah.
Oh, the other thing, Darkest Dungeon is essentially cookie clicker. That is a phrase that you design and say to get somebody to punch you.
It's like a discourse bot. I've seen that video.
Okay.
You know, Joseph Anderson lost me at some point, but there are videos that he's done that I liked. His point was, the way he was playing it was like a traditional kind of JRPG where you had to grind up levels.
Oh.
He never unlocked like a rhythm of the game of heroes being disposable.
Right.
So like, he just thought you just go through these levels and do them over and over again until you're high enough level to beat the game.
Oh.
Like, he just like fundamentally missed something very early that caused a lot of bad takes.
Okay. And then he got it eventually and said like, actually it's good for these reasons.
No, he never got it. Like, he would go back to it, you know, Franzing, mm-hmm. if you know, if he did, maybe he'd think it was good, but I don't think he ever went back to it.
If he were to do another video on it now. Yeah.
Maybe. Yeah. It's hard to tell with him. I think he just never understood the game.
Yeah.
Like, what it's trying to do. And it's a weird fucking game. Like, you know, treating your characters as disposable, having multiple teams and stuff, like, that is not something that video games train you to do. Not trying to like sympathize with Joseph Anderson. I agree, it's a bad video. But I think that was his problem with that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, we talk about this. We talk about games that we have podcasted about that we would go back and, you know, redo.
Yeah.
It is hard to think of one that we haven't kind of hit before in this.
Yeah, there's stuff that I know that I would be slightly meaner about. There's stuff that I also feel like I would be, I wish we had done more depth on, but we've kind of done some of that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Like going back and doing Tony Hawk 3.
Yeah.
Was good to me because it's like, oh, you know, I wanted to talk about Tony Hawk with my current brain. You know, mm-hmm. even though we did do a different game, going back to it, I don't think our old Tony Hawk episode was bad, but I just wanted to think about it in a new way.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. What's Peyton say? Oh no, this is me. What Peyton mm-hmm. says is, I know I'm double dipping this month, but I also recently played Celeste and was incredibly excited to see that you had covered it. Kay, I was wondering if you had any specific read on the game now that you're out as trans. More power to you, girl. Thank you. I don't know. Like, I saw the metaphor back in the day, but like when we talked about it in depth, wasn't psychologically to a place where I could say like, yeah, this dissect it live or dissect it in the notes, just wasn't self-accepting or recognizing then. And if I was, I would not want to take a very sympathetic and in-depth read on that because it would be very difficult to explain. Additionally, I do not bear the flag for all trans people in narrative, so I do not feel comfortable planting it into that. I understand that Maddie is trans, and that realization kind of came after they worked on it.
Yeah, it wasn't something that was done like baked into the game unless it was like subconscious, right? Like it's a flexible metaphor, Celeste.
Absolutely. Like I can see that, you know, and a lot of these metaphors end up being used a little bit kind of like interchangeably, but like you could see it for, you know, for your sexuality, for realizing your kind of neurodivergence, any number of these things. Like I think that like anything where there is something inside yourself that you know is off and there is conflict and something trying to assert itself and kind of growing to accept and then work within that and become, you know, better integrate it to become more than you were. Yeah, that can be a ton of stuff.
It makes me think that, you know, the story of the developer of Maddie, you know, discovering that they were trans and then the little trans flag on like the character's ending thing and stuff has for some people, I'm not accusing Peyton of this or anyone really, but I think it can have like a reductive effect on the game. You know, I'm not trying to take anything away from anybody. I'd never want to take representation away from people. But like, if you look at Celeste, like it feels like that game is about a more general thing that can also apply to this.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, it feels slightly more inclusive to me as a metaphor.
Yeah. And that's pretty much how I feel about it. Like if I went back and did a beat by beat analysis and say like, oh, I sympathize with this, this, and this, but also that is a game that is about a journey that I did not take at the time we covered it. So
yeah.
And I haven't played it since.
Trial Fight says, I was playing Dragon Age Inquisition many years back, and I lost it when, during a serious conversation about refugees, a peasant manifested in a Jesus Christ pose 2 feet above the ground below a stone archway, shotgunning baskets and debris across the countryside. Do you have any examples that come to mind of a glitch or rough edges in a game cracking you up? It happens all the time, but it's hard to think about. You know, I have like a go-to example, and then I feel self-conscious because I use it.
Because he's, you know, all but the time. Yeah,
because it's just the one. But Fallout 3, going through the sewers the first time, killing a mire lurk, and it doing Bethesda glitch stuff in the water. Mm-hmm. So it sounded like something was stalking me in the water. Yeah, there's like splish splashing, and I was looking around for it and very scared. And then when I found the corpse, it was just a little like blah, 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 you know, vibrating Gamebryo engine monster. And that was really fun. Mm-hmm. You know, I think that we're both team. Every time this happens, it's great.
Yes.
It's a blessing.
Yeah. I can't think of anything like very specifically, probably because the example that Trial Flight gave is so funny. Just the idea.
It's great.
Love it. T-posing it and launching it across. You spoke too vividly, Trial Flight. You overrode anything that I had.
It's good when that happens.
Exotic Minivan asks, how often do you have to look at guides while playing games from WoW? I was able to play the first 4 Silent Hills on original hardware, but at times I had to use guides. I felt bad about it at first because I felt like I should have been able to figure it out. Ultimately, I had the skills to complete the games, even if I didn't know to put the rubber ball into the hole on the roof.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I always will look at a guide before I start playing something because that's how I portion out. That's how I budget my time. That's me looking at a table of contents though. So like maybe I'll see like a spoiler for like a third act thing, but like if I don't look ahead of time, I don't know how to keep on pace.
Yeah. I will sometimes do that if I want to see how much of a game seems like it's left.
Uh-huh.
You know, for things, as we found out, like how long to beat is often inaccurate.
Yes.
In terms of how to get past something from time to time, you know, especially if it is something that's like a, you know, a hinty puzzly game. I did that, you know, with some limited like times in the Talos Principle, for example.
Yeah.
Like I, you know, looked up a thing or two. I don't think you should feel bad about this and I don't think it matters.
Yeah.
Personally, like, you can't be expected to read the mind of the developer. Like, yes, you could probably figure it out and you can rest assured that you could like got a long enough timeline. Of course you could. And anybody is capable of figuring this stuff out. It's not, I don't feel like even like the most tricky games, I think you can probably get them eventually long enough timeline. It's just, you're deciding whether you want to,
yeah,
you know, nothing wrong with looking something up.
Mm-hmm. If it is something where I absolutely have to resort to it, I tend to call it out. I tend to say, like, yeah, like this tripped me up and I had to look and here was what I was not seeing. Right.
Yeah. Yeah. And sometimes, you know, there's also like a gamer psychographic, whether you place the locus of blame for everything within yourself or if you share that with a dev.
Yeah.
You know, it's kind of a philosophy thing. I feel like there are people who take every possible problem they can have with a game. And of course it's them. You know, the dev is flawless. I personally don't think creative work works that way.
No.
You know, things like the rubber ball in the hole in the roof or like Silent Hill puzzles, sometimes those are counterintuitive. Like, a thing to remember, I think, is that people making games aren't sitting down and crafting masterpieces brick by brick. It's a huge team of people making a thing through under studio pressure, you know, and there are compromises made constantly.
Yeah.
You don't need to take that responsibility onto yourself.
No.
Personally, you know, I think.
Agree.
So be kind to yourself.
Please.
Yeah. Luke says, someone puts a gun to your head and tells you to choose between Dark Souls and Elden Ring. What has driven them to do this? Do you believe there is a right answer you can give them? Assuming they spare your life, do you call the police? If they don't, should the next step be punishment or helping this individual? What caused this crime? Video games, guns, or the polarized American society? Good question.
Very good question. Hard-hitting, timely.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Your hand's covered with blood. You can't try to grip the handle.
Yeah, yeah. So to choose like which one is better or which one you only ever get to play. I'm sorry, I'm parsing every fucking question, but it's kind of my move and I don't know how to approach this. Like if I to strike one from existence while the other stays and that's all that I have, Dark Souls.
Yeah. I go back and forth. I love both those games for different reasons. Like,
yeah,
Dark Souls for repeating play, probably, which is a wild thing to say because it has fewer builds and stuff, but I couldn't lose that. If I was thinking of my first playthrough, then my first playthrough of Elden Ring was really magical.
Yeah.
Exploring in the game is super fun.
Yeah.
The reason they did this, if they did this, I don't want to sound like a bad leftist, but I probably would call the cops.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I don't know what else
are they for?
Yeah. Like I'm not, you know, I don't know what else to do in that scenario. We don't have others. There's no one else to call.
Yeah.
You know, there's a default for that. Yeah. And in terms of like what they should be punished for, you know, if they didn't kill me, you know, if they were just having a bad moment and stuff, I would like to think of restorative justice.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't think they get to have guns for a while.
Yeah. Like no, you know, no guns and like, I don't know. I would like to be able to talk to them and come to peace with why they made that decision. Like I would like to have some reparations for my stress and turmoil at that.
Yes. Would really want them to understand that they did something bad, like how that affected me. Yeah.
Yeah. And video games or guns didn't cause the crime, even though I'm not crazy about guns. And it might've been polarized American society, but it does feel like Elden Ring and Dark Souls aren't something on one half of a political divide.
Right.
You know, so I think it might just be their own personal mental health. Like it might be the rare case where that's actually is a lone wolf with bad mental health.
If it's related to the polarization, it is so far downstream as to be indistinguishable. I have trouble blaming it on anybody but the person who held the gun in that instance.
Yeah. And I don't know. Right. So like it's possible that there are YouTube, you know, right wing fash pipeline YouTube videos about holding up podcasters and making them choose between Dark Souls and Elden Ring. I don't know about that. And if so, it's not my business. I don't, you know, until it's suddenly very much my business. Like I don't care to know about that.
Yeah. Want to do Jack's and then move on to another thing.
Sure.
Yeah. So Jack,
it's me.
Yeah. Sorry.
Wake up, Kay. It's sorry, time to get in the game.
Yep. Okay. Yeah. Lock in.
Lock in.
Jack asks, best gaming related art purchase or possession?
Yeah.
Yeah.
What do you got?
Yeah. So I have a lot. I have so much. I have lots of like wall art and posters, some of which like fans have made, you know, and sent. I'm thinking of this one specifically, but I believe it was Jack who sent me like a sculpted like clay version of the Portrait for the Inland Empire skill from Disco Elysium.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, I have that affixed. I have that affixed. It's above my my coffee maker, so I like look at that every day.
That's real cool.
And I, you know, love that game. Love the writing for that particular character. So I'm gonna say that one because it is handmade. Nothing else is like it. The one I'm having most fun with is my little Lego piranha plant that's on my desk right here, and that is a really good little kit.
Nice. Yeah, I too have a bunch of these kind of things. I'm looking right now at two, my Maniac Mansion Shadow Box, which I really like.
Oh yeah,
after a convention, and then my carved wood thing that Will got me for my 44th birthday. Mm-hmm. That is my favorite quote from Disco Elysium. You know, there's still time. You're 44 years old. There's still time.
Yeah,
that's right above my monitor, so I look at that all the time. Those are probably the two biggest ones.
Yeah, but
I love this kind of shit.
Yeah, my shadow box is great. I have that on the wall in my bedroom.
Yeah, it's super nice. Yeah, I love it. It's very good. The got a lifestyle question here. Jordan and Maya M say, "Hello, my favorite podcasters. I'm back. I ask a question that hints as to why I've been a bit absent. Have either of you ever had a moment of clarity where you realized you are currently unhappy and are now taking steps to build the future you want to live in? If so, how are you doing now? I hope y'all are happy." All caps. If that question is too heavy, which Resident Evil game would you want Gordon Ramsay to do a Let's Play of? They must complete and offer themed recipes per segment.
Oh, Resident Evil 7.
That's pretty fun. That's definitely the themed recipe one.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, even though it'd be fun to give them like Dead Aim. Bloody hell. Tyrant Factory. Fuck me.
I can't hit this damn dog.
Yeah. Gordon Ramsay has skin cancer.
Does he?
Yeah. It's a bummer. I like that man a lot. I think he's one of history's greatest like weirdos.
Yeah. 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 Well, hope he's okay. I mean,
yeah,
I hope he caught him in time.
Yeah. Yeah. Big time.
Yeah. I'm not going to answer, you know, it's pretty clear.
Yeah. You wrote about it. We can all look at the post.
It's there.
Sure. This happened a bunch of times where I'm like unhappy. This is what I was really unhappy at my job. That's when went back to school, which was not, did not make me happy. It just made me not work at my job back in the day. That was a mistake, but at the time I needed it.
Yeah.
Currently going through a mini version of that with detoxing from internet and news.
Yeah.
Which has been awesome. I've been very successful at it. I don't have social media channels right now, and I don't learn about things that are happening.
Yeah.
And stuff leaks in. It's like it happens. There's leakage. Mm-hmm. But it's awesome. Like, and nice. Nothing has changed for me. I couldn't do anything before. I can't do anything now.
Yeah.
So I'm just less crazy feeling.
Yeah. Valuable.
Super valuable. Still depressed. Still have the same mental health that I used to have and everything, but I'm not worried about things I can't do anything about as much.
Yeah.
The love that serenity prayer.
Move on to media. KL writes, "I hate wizards. One particular mechanical package that does everything with an ignorable cost and obsoletes the mechanics of everyone else at the table. That is bad design. And that's putting aside the tech bro stink of a class being all powerful because the character is objectively smarter than everyone else. You both seem pretty big on wizards during the Baldur's Gate 3 season of Real Lich Hours. So I was surprised to hear you down on Tremere during a more recent Real Lich Hours episode. Sincere question, not trying to gotcha you. But what is the difference between Tremere do-it-all magic and Tremere do-it-all magic and D&D wizard do-it-all magic for you?"
I don't know. I don't remember being super down on the Tremere outside of their like one, the blood magic thing just kept going.
Just the bloat.
And,
yeah.
Yeah. The bloat. And that was more being frustrated at like a feature creep.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of thing. And then they're like dorky hierarchies, I think. Yeah. Is a little nerdy, you know, for it. I guess the difference being like in D&D, like there are a bunch of different kinds of wizards. Like when I say wizard, a lot of times I'm thinking of like general caster class.
Yeah.
So I'm thinking of sorcerers and bards and shit like that. Like generally somebody who does magic.
Mm-hmm.
It's not, I think magic is cool. you know.
If your setting allows for it, it's one of the cooler things to happen in it.
Yeah. And maybe a little bit that Tremere feels a little bit like a hat on a hat.
Yeah.
Like you have all these vampires with superpowers, you mm-hmm. know, but having, you know, everybody having superpowers and having one person that can do superpowers and magic.
It's pulling a Swiss Army knife and rock, paper, scissors.
A little bit.
Yeah. I like the aesthetics and trappings of a wizard. I do not like a wizard who is just smarter than everybody. I think that, you know, just the high intelligence thing, that can be a flaw if you're playing it interestingly. And if you are at a table, the people around you, if you are not doing it, should be goading you into doing better.
Yeah.
You know, or your dungeon master should be guiding you, I believe. Mechanically, this is one of the reasons why I like sorcerers a lot, because they can't just look at a scroll and get everything. They have slots. You need to make choices as you go.
Yeah. Part of the joy is the mechanical part of it. It's not just the versatility.
Yeah.
You know, even a sorcerer has the slots, even a wizard has to like memorize in advance.
Yeah.
As a thing. So it's kind of a planning thing. It's like a blending of the flavor of thinking magic is cool and the mechanics being more complicated than like hidden stuff.
Yeah.
You know, I also really love thieves. Like I love rogues. I play those a lot at the table and stuff. I think those are cool too.
Yeah.
You know, I basically just don't like fighters, like a Bruja, a Gengar, a fighter, a barbarian. All of that stuff doesn't do anything for me.
Yeah.
I want to be able to do something other than fight.
Mm-hmm. You know. Makes sense.
Yeah. Amy says, would love an update on Gary's The Terror viewing. I watched it for the first time before it actually aired because I was working at the production company that made it, and they wanted me to catalog all the different costumes for some reason or another. It was a shitty compressed video with a big-ass watermark, and I went from insanely tuned out at the outset to absolutely loving it.
That's neat. A cool story.
That is cool. That's awesome. Loved it. Really, really liked it. I think it begins and kind of middles stronger than it ends. I talked about this on Quackstack.
Yeah.
The Terror is super cool. First season. I haven't watched the second season of it, but it is well worth watching. It is cool and scary. And Arctic horror, Arctic expeditions generally are cool.
Yeah.
Yeah. Liked it a lot.
Yeah. I haven't seen it, so I can't add anything other than eventually I will.
Yeah, it's good.
Yeah. I believe you.
I know. You believe Amy.
Both of you. Amy worked on it, kind of.
Yeah.
Last media question here. Nolan writes, if HBO rebooted Tales from the Crypt and hired you as the showrunner, what are some decisions that you would make? For the sake of discussion, you can assume that you have a decent-sized budget. Mm. Beat still my heart.
Yeah. Be fun to do. Showrunner is such a fun, nebulous job.
I know,
like I'm sure, right? That does a lot of stuff, but just kind of like, this is my vision.
God, I could just reach out to cool writers and say, hey, you've wanted to work on Tales from the Crypt for your entire life, right? Do you want to make a cool episode? Let's talk about it.
Yeah.
Like that would be the coolest thing, is just to like use that clout to get in the room with cool people and just give them free reign to do it.
With them pitch, you know, so with a big budget as a thing. I for sure. And I would want to bring it a little bit back to its 90s. Like I would want to get character actors and big stars who are slumming it.
Yeah.
To the degree that you could.
Mm-hmm.
And I would want it to be fun.
Yes.
And I might do something crazy, like only practical effects.
That's what I was thinking too. Like taking it back to the 90s in a lot of regards, or, you know, something that could be very plausibly, you know, practical effects, right? Like do like a Mad Max Fury Road. I understand that all of that, you know, was treated. It's not as practical as everybody kind of assumes it is, but like a lot of it is enough of it to make it feel badass and real. Do something like that.
Are happening.
But sculptures and puppets and stuff.
Lots of puppets and stuff, like a little CG.
Yeah.
That'd be real fun. Mm-hmm. It would also be fun to like find a set of writers who had an idea and do something that is like a Tales from the Crypt, six episodes, like kind of like the King of the Hill reboot, where it's serialized, but also not.
Oh, yeah.
You know, a six episode thing that does kind of like, not tell a complete story, you know, point to point, but like is a slight, you know, Monster of the Week kind of blurred a little bit.
Yeah.
It'd be cool to see something, it build to something. you know, and yeah. also I think it would make it more likely to be successful because anthology shows don't tend to do very well.
Right. At least one episode that is like not explicitly supernatural horror. I'm thinking the something as weird as and akin to the gambling episode that we covered and the unfilmable we did. Yeah.
Yeah. Like going back to those old stories would be really fun. You know, like they had gone to the other book, the like Western stories or whatever for that one. And there's a whole suite of those.
Yeah.
Like the shocking suspense stories. one of the sloppiest portmanteaus of all time.
Yeah.
Yeah. That would be great. Hook us up, Nolan. moving on to show questions. Skylar says, I know you've done some inclusion of games mods as side notes for things like Fallout or Dark Souls, but do you see any of the giant transformative ones as having a place on the network? For instance, could you see doing a WAF episode on something like Fallout London or Portal Reloaded or Black Mesa, if that'd be less of a stretch? There's a stock answer that we have for stuff. Mm-hmm. It's a little tricky. We try to, are not super concerned with this, but we do try to keep a balance of how much the kind of like user base a game has.
Yeah.
Whether people will be interested. And it always feels a little bit like mods for each person who's like, yeah, no, I want to hear about that mod. They're just a bunch of people who are like, that's fake.
You know? Yeah. It's kind of in the same lane as covering something in VR.
A little bit.
Yeah.
Like a much smaller install base, like user base.
Everybody fucking wants to hear about Half-Life Alyx, but like, I believe that Walkabout Mini Golf is an amazing game. One of the best in the past recent memory. Also, who's going to listen to us talk about it? How much is there to say about it, right?
Especially since we've already done a lot of golf stuff.
Yeah.
You know, it's doing it in VR makes it different, but there's only so many ways. Like, you end up turning into, Bob Odenkirk explaining Calvin and Hobbes. I just you could see it.
If only you could see it.
It's scary, but it's kind of weird. You know, like, you end up doing that kind of thing.
Yeah.
So not officially off the table or anything. We are doing Clan Quest mod for Bloodlines on Real Star Wars as we speak.
Yeah.
That's probably the closest to this we've done. And I'm always interested in this stuff, but I never like have time to do it.
I need to engineer a way that you'll play the Kendo's Cut mods for RE2.
I would like to play the Goofy mods for that.
Yeah.
That's a fun idea. Those are interesting to me.
Mm-hmm.
It's just hard to fit in. You know, and Black Mesa would be hard to fit in because it's a remake of a game we already did.
Right.
You know, we covered Half-Life. Like, when we do something that is based, even if it's mechanically very different, if we do something that's based on a game we've already done, we're basically excising plot from the episode.
Right. Yeah.
You know, and that gets a little tricky.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. Let's see. Andrew writes, I forget if you got a question like this before, but would you ever consider WAF awards for games that you covered in a year? Maybe as part of the December dispatch, maybe you could have some Slack or Patreon voting to suggest categories and audience choice winners. In addition to y'all's picks, it could be duck themed, like highest concentration of I get it buttons or most should have been an abject suffering game or /least/GaryNip/most/least/KNIP. Totally get it if it sounds like too much extra work for y'all and Gwen, but it could be a fun way to look back on a given WAF year and see what kinds of trends and patterns emerged in what you covered.
I've never really thought about it before.
No.
Yeah, I don't know. I'm not against it. Mm-hmm. I got no strong feelings on that one way or another.
Yeah, it sounds like it could be fun and goofy. I'm too close to the stuff that we're covering to be able to come up with a way to do that. That is not just me designing a situation where I can just give like summary thoughts, like year in review kind of things. Right? Like there's a place for year in review stuff. I like doing that, like in a social media thread or whatever, but like as an award, I don't know.
Yeah. We would need the audience participation. Like I almost feel like we need a rubric that we didn't come up with.
Yeah. That's the thing,
you know, almost for that. So like, but it's not a bad idea or anything. It would be fun and it would be easy and goofy.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
But yeah. What about doing something like with a draft of games we've covered on WAF? Like, you know, just like pick a couple of different categories, do like blind voting with the listeners, picking, you know, just ranking like, oh, here are my favorites of these. And then, just like putting our teams up against each other and seeing who comes out ahead.
Sure.
Yeah. But, no. Also a lot of work.
Yeah. A lot of work. Moving on to the lightning round.
Yeah.
Eric says, what's your favorite old person food and or hobby? I love me some liverwurst and antique roadshow.
Liverwurst.
You're half right. Yeah. Like literally fucking disgusting. Like,
yeah. No, thank you. I just had Dennis and Moxie over earlier in the summer just to kind of hang out folks from the level. They were giving me shit about my big glass jar of root beer barrel candies.
That is an old person candy.
Yeah. But they're good, Gary.
They're okay. Yeah, they got like a root beer barrel from time to time. Not turning it down.
They're not too sweet.
No, I mean, that's true. Yeah, it is one of the things you want in a candy, not sweet. Yeah. I also love Antique Roadshow. Mm-hmm. So I'm with Eric on that one. I will watch any number of things like that, basically. I also like antiquing itself. Mm-hmm. Me and my wife go thrifting. We don't buy a lot of antiques, but we love doing that kind of thing. And it's a very old person coded thing.
Yeah.
We went on a trip to Salem, Oregon, the capital of the state, which is not a cool town. Like, there's not a lot of cool stuff to do there, but we mostly just went to go to antique stores and bookstores.
Yeah.
That. And old person food, in the right context, I like cottage cheese. I think that's kind of an old person food.
Yeah, that's real old. That's real old coded.
That's pretty old coded. I'm not like eating it with a tuna plate, you know, or something like that. Like, it could be more old person coded, like just an ice cream scoop of it next to some tuna on a piece of lettuce.
Oh.
But I am like something I've seen before at restaurants, like served on like the seniors menu.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, but like, I like a, you know, if I have a proper like chip or salty thing to dip, like a cottage cheese, that's probably the oldest person old food I like. In addition to like classics that you don't hear about, like I like meatloaf. Meatloaf's great.
Yeah.
You know, that's definitely an old person food at this point.
Yeah. We've got a restaurant in town called Granny's. It's Granny's Kitchen. They serve a bunch of that shit. Yeah.
Good. Sorry. Liv and I watched a YouTube. There's a restaurant in New York where they just had grandma's cook. They have an Italian grandma on chef all the time, but then they have a rotating grandma.
Oh my God. Grandma of the day.
Yeah. Like a grandma of the week. And like, they're from different nationalities. So you go there and it's like, oh, this is like a Bolivian grandma. This is like a, you know, Hispanic grandma, and just grandma's cooking grandma food.
Awesome.
Like, you don't, it's not like a whole menu. It's like they have the grandma thing they make and you eat it. I want to go there so fucking bad. Like, I'm like, that is the best idea for a restaurant. Like, just grandma food rules. And it's like these very sweet old ladies cooking, and you, like, they come out and you tell them how good it is, and they, you call them young lady, you know, and it seems perfect.
Mm-hmm.
Mm, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I love that idea. That is such a good idea. I always think that I associate grapefruit with old people. And that is a fruit that I cannot have. It is literally a forbidden fruit because of medications. So yeah, hate it. I love that kind of like bitter tang to it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Missing that grapefruit. Oh, well.
Yeah. Game says, these are two here, says, my worst body horror fear is having my eyeballs plucked out. My friend said his is going down a giant cheese grater. What are your worst body horror fears?
Both of those sound bad, but the eyeball one isn't the worst one to me.
No.
Like being cleansed, I think.
Yeah, getting Dagoned. Yeah, I think about that a lot. Anything that you have to live with for a while that does not, anything that's chronic but not acute, right? Yeah. So like, this is a common one, but the trypophobia thing. But what if you just start getting holes?
Yeah,
like there's a status effect in that World of Horror game, which I'm always on the edge of bringing to the show, that is just holes. You know, like, what if you get holes? That I think bugs me the most. I'm not trying to be like low millennial coded, but yeah, the trypophobia thing wigs me out.
Holes would be weird.
Yeah.
Not having skin like losing my skin. Cause the living through it is really key.
Yeah.
You know, if somebody, like somebody snapped their fingers and you had no skin, like you wouldn't die right away.
Mm-hmm.
You'd wish you were dead, you know, yeah. like tons of pain. You'd be like Carl when he was made of eyeballs. Like, why does everything hurt?
If I woke up like that, I would walk toward the nearest thing and kill it. Yeah,
exactly. Like it just really, really terrifying stuff. I'm a big wuss about pain. I do not like pain.
Yeah.
I'm not interested in pain.
Okay, I'm going to ask you something. Does this count as body horror? The thing from the Illithid kind of like source book from second edition. Not I Tyrant, but whatever. It's the Illithid, which is a psionic curse that makes it so you cannot breathe unless you consciously think about it.
Yeah.
Is that body horror?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Then that one for sure.
Yeah. That's really rough.
Yeah. I think about that a lot.
It's really bad. The horrible thing to do to somebody. Yeah.
Gabriel also asks, I already asked you about big dog shirts a long time ago, but I'm going to double dip just because I want an excuse to hear you talk about big dogs. Any recent favorites?
I haven't had any recent big dogs at all.
No.
Recent unfavorites even. I feel like big dogs, you know, I just haven't seen them. Like I'm sure they're still around. You can't put them down. Mm-hmm. You know, they fight you.
Yeah.
You know,
I'm a big fan of I just went to the site. They have Dog of the Hill, greetings from Snarlin, Texas.
Don't mind that.
Featuring you have labeled characters standing by the fence in the alley. Airedale, Hound Hill, Doggy Hill, Billy Bark, and Boom Howler.
All of those except for Boom Howler suck.
Yep.
Like the would it be bad?
Would it be big dogs if it didn't suck though?
yeah. It's just weird that they got Boom Howler. Like they did one good one.
Yeah.
I would love to have some more updates on big dogs. I have a bookmark that I won't get rid of, which is the big dogs like parody shirt that's like, listen here, bud, America deserved 9/11. And I'm always tempted by it, but I don't want to be killed or like fought for a shirt.
Even in Portland, right?
Like even in Portland, like you know, bad luck. And it's arguably in bad taste.
Yeah.
You know, it is arguably in bad taste.
Is it a bad taste of, no.
Yeah, you know, and it's also, to be fair, not something I necessarily believe. I don't want innocent people to die for anything.
No.
You know, like there's U.S. foreign policy is more complicated than I feel like getting into or no, but like, I don't want anyone innocent to die. I don't believe in acceptable casualties for shit like that. So I don't actually believe it. The posture of the shirt is so fucking funny though.
It is very funny.
The smug dog just being like, listen, bud, like buckle up. Like the big dog is going to lay some truth on you is a very funny posture for that.
Yeah.
To me.
Oh man. The confrontationalness of that I think is very good.
And that's my favorite thing a big dog shirt can do. Listen up, court it, you know, the class is in session. It's just very funny to me. Yeah. Kale asks, Gary, you mentioned a couple of weeks back that you were a Kinks fan. What are your favorite albums? And does it ever get not kind of weird to listen to Muswell Hillbillies? No, it is always a little weird.
What's weird about it?
It's just like they kind of do concept albums.
Yeah.
And it's a weird concept album. Like look it up. Like there are bangers on that album. But it reminds me a little bit of like Southern Accents just sitting in the Tom Petty catalog just waiting to jump scare you. You know? My favorite Kinks album is Village Green Preservation Society. I love that record. But I love all of the Golden Era Kinks.
Cool.
Power Man versus all those records. Great. Spin them frequently. Kinks secret. Their B-sides are fucking incredible as well. You'll have things like I think Mindless Child of Motherhood is a B-side.
Okay.
And that's fucking nuts. Like to take that song and be like, nobody really needs to hear this is crazy.
It is funny what they decide to, relegate to that.
Yeah. A lot of, since I went through my Kinks phase early in life, Mm-hmm. The reason why I'm not being super specific with every record something's from is because I don't necessarily know. I've kind of harvested from that golden age all the songs I like on a big playlist.
Yeah.
So they kind of stick together for me. I have some of them on vinyl, but my record player is downstairs in the basement. Don't spend much time down there. So
Yeah. Another one from KL. Music in horror movies kind of sucks. What was the last memorable score you heard in a horror film? And can you hum a few bars off of the top of your head?
I cannot.
No, I disagree that music in horror movies kind of sucks.
I see where they're coming from a little bit. Yeah. Like it's not, I don't think it necessarily sucks across the way, but I think that I'm just, you know, this is more tones.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like this is just going to be some swells and stuff like that. That's feels parallel to music to me sometimes.
Yeah. And I guess memorable here is that.
Yeah.
After we talked about The Thing, I've had the In the Mouth of Madness soundtrack on. One is composed, scored by John Carpenter. It's good. It's a good soundtrack. Can't hum anything from it, but I like it.
It's definitely a thing I feel like where older movies did have more, like old John Carpenter soundtracks are great. Mm-hmm. Like a bunch of those, or you'd get an old horror movie and it's scored by Goblin. And you're like, fuck yes. You know, current horror movies where it's a lot of like just kind of dissonant swells, I am less into. Like, I think that can be very effective, but I don't want to listen to it.
It lives so much alongside the visuals that you can't like just listen to on its own as a composition.
Yeah. Yeah. I remember. I tend not to notice it in modern horror movies. I'm trying to think of the last like modern horror movie where I really noticed the score.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Really like licensed songs. I like how the Hollies are used in Heretic.
Yeah.
There's a Bread song at the end of Beau Is Afraid that I really love. you know, but it's not a, I know, like, I would, there you go. Like Ari Aster does pretty good music stuff.
Mm-hmm.
The soundtrack to Midsommar is really good. The score. And then when he does soundtrack stuff, like the big musical scenes in both Beau Is Afraid and in Eddington are both great.
Mm-hmm.
That one is Katy Perry's Fireworks. And that's excellent. That's really, really well deployed in a way that you might not expect, but like, that's very, very well done.
Yeah.
That's probably my answer.
Okay.
For that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Moving on to topic.
Let's go to the topic. I don't know that this is going to be an incredibly long one.
Yeah, that's okay.
That's okay. Care writes, Vampire the Masquerade Bloodlines is an adaptation of a tabletop RPG that is typically played with several PCs making up a coterie. Your character's personality is what drives the plot, and your skills are the only ones that you have access to. By contrast, Baldur's Gate 3 emphasizes the party-based nature of the game, having companions with different personalities, goals, and skill sets. I'm wondering if you can talk about the differences between solo CRPGs and party-based CRPGs, both as games and as adaptations of the tabletop RPG experience. Obviously, there's room for both in the world, but what are the advantages and disadvantages of each kind of game, and how do you think they can shore up their respective weaknesses?
Yeah. Interesting like idea, because like, you think about computer RPGs. And one of the things I was thinking about when we decided to do this question is that almost all of them that are single character-based are not turn-based.
Yeah.
They do conflict resolution, you know, through combat in another genre's skin.
Yeah.
You know, you get your like Fallout 3, which kind of makes a nod towards that with VATS, but it's mostly a shooter. Vampire, which is mostly a shooter or third-person melee. Witcher, which is kind of a vague Souls-like,
you know,
or Witcher 3, and then Witcher 1 is like a vague third-person Diablo-like almost. I don't know how you describe the click to attack stuff in Witcher 1, but they tend to use another genre for their combat.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, I'm trying to like reconcile that with like, you know, the early Baldur's Gate. Like, would you consider like real time with pause? Because like that to me controls so much like an RTS.
Yeah.
It is hard not to see that borrowing as well. Like, at what point are we considering like the RPG, the combat is playing out in something that is not RPG? Is it just turn-based? Is it just tactical?
Well, we're landing on something that is like RPG doesn't have a combat system.
Right.
Uh-huh. Which is weird to admit, yeah. But it's true. Like when you say RPG combat, you think about Final Fantasy, or I do, yeah. But that's not actually very representative.
Yeah.
You know, of things, or you think of like wizardry or anything like that, but that's just a subset. And that's why you get TDM of people being like, you can't use JRPG as a genre because what about Dark Souls?
Right.
You know, like that's technically a role-playing game and technically Japanese. Gotcha. I'll see you tomorrow, or I'll see you next year, says somebody on New Year's Eve. you know, that kind of shit. So I think that mechanically, I think that tends to be the thing, like a single player turn-based thing. Like it does mean you usually have, not always, because there are exceptions, right? Like you end up mm-hmm. with real time with pause stuff, but tend to have to borrow something.
Yeah. Yeah. This gets into something too. I don't know that I primarily think of like any of the Fallouts as like party based, right? Like even the early ones, I don't know, the companions that you get, the party members feel tertiary.
They're really optional.
Yeah.
Like, you know, those games are interesting because especially 2 is designed for the permadeath.
Yeah.
You know, there are enough companions and companions that duplicate roles to where like you're supposed to, you know, an intended way to play his role with it.
No, Myron is supposed to die in ignominy, right?
Yeah. You know, and you replace him with the Skynet computer mm-hmm. when you go to that next like section or what have you, or Goris. Yeah. Like you are meant to not just choose a party and have them go through the thing.
Yeah.
The thing with you. So they are kind of accessories to your main character. The other thing I was thinking about that intersects with this is blank slateness.
Yeah.
You know, which tends to be like, if you are a single character, you tend to be not having a defined character.
To the point where The Witcher feels like such an exception.
Yes. You know, whereas a party-based thing, because they're designing a whole party, sometimes you're playing a blank slate, you know, but everyone else, like it's not always like Baldur's Gate 3 or Divinity Original Sin 2, where they've created a bunch of characters you can play.
Yeah.
And have their backdrop. Like a lot of times you might play a blank slate, but there's stories they want to tell in the world with characters.
Yeah.
Within there.
I have never, like in, like just like, let's say Baldur's Gate 3, but also like in similar situations, like I don't consider my Tavs to be a character, or like Shepherd to be a character. Like those are games that are just so much about the companions and the way they interact with each other to me, that like nothing about like my dude or lady is interesting enough to override that. The decisions that I make inside of it are, you know, cool and neat, but that has very little to do with the character that I'm playing as.
For me, it depends. Like in Baldur's Gate 3, my first Tav I based on my current like tabletop character, and my second one was the Dark Urge, which is basically not a Tav.
Right.
Yeah. You know? So I did. But when I think about Mass Effect, like I don't really think Shepard's a character.
No.
You know, Shepard's a menu that you get to choose things from sometimes. Like Shepard's not a character though.
No.
You know, as a thing. So like, it's interesting the way these things intersect. The advantage are obviously like if you have a party, you get interaction with it.
Yeah.
You have people for your main character to talk. You get to make your shepherd make decisions at,
mm-hmm.
you know, these things like, and even that's, you know, mean to Mass Effect, but even like New Vegas or something,
yeah.
having Veronica there to expose you to new ideas and everything and make you make choices about the world and her,
yeah.
her systems and her faction.
Yeah. I mean, I guess I'll, you know, instead of taking a shot at Mass Effect, a series that has definitely lost the shine for me, but you know, we excoriated the first one a few years back, talking about like a game, you know, games we enjoy, my player character in the Shadowrun games and the Harebrained Scheme ones, I don't really think of them as a guy. I can't remember any decision that I made with them because I'm thinking about Glory, right?
Yeah it's really just the people you're next to.
Yeah.
You know, do that. So I guess like that is probably the biggest advantage of a party-based mm-hmm. CRPG is that you tend to, with some exceptions, like there's exceptions to all of this stuff, right?
Yes.
Like
yeah.
the way The Witcher gets around it, you don't have companions, so you don't have a ready source of those stories, but you go out and get them in the world.
Yeah, they're secondary characters that you get with the various side quests, and so many of them are memorable. Yeah.
Yeah, and The Witcher is about Geralt. Mm-hmm. Like, it's not about an anonymous, pile of decisions. It's not about a shepherd. Mm-hmm. And that's rare, though. We called that out at the time. It's exceedingly rare to have a solo RPG where you play as a defined character.
Yeah.
I almost can't think of any other ones.
I don't know. I really can't. Yeah.
Somebody might make the argument that Shepard's like a character. Somebody right. might, get irritated or disagree with that. But I can't think of one where it's like, oh, no, this is a person. They have a backstory and stuff. I guess what is it called? Anachronox?
Oh, I've never played that, so I can't tell you.
Oh, you might like Anachronox. It's like a fast
FF7 alike.
Yeah, yeah. Fast follow from Final Fantasy VII, but with like better and funnier writing, IMO.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't go for as deep a theme, but it doesn't like weird localization distancing.
Yeah.
And it's not about Gaia theory.
So I'm trying to think of like any other thoughts that I had about this. Why haven't we seen a party-based vampire game?
Yeah.
Like, I've not played all of them, but like Requiem, that one is solo, I believe.
Yeah. Like, you have companions in that.
Yeah.
In Requiem. But it's not, I think it's a limited number of companions. I think it's closer to a New Vegas. I need to mm-hmm. play that. Like, I don't necessarily know that I'm going to beat it, but I want to play it so I can talk about it on the show. I just haven't gotten around to it yet.
Yeah. Yeah. But yeah, it just kind of seems, because Care does have a point, like that in the tabletop, like you are with a group of people, you're a coterie.
Yeah. Yeah. It really has to do with like what you're doing with your protagonist, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah. I guess in that, like, one of the reasons why not having a group of vampires, is that, and I think this has been true to my limited experience of playing the tabletop game of vampire, mm-hmm. but like vampires are all kind of main characters.
Yeah.
Like they're all vampires. Like they're all, and part of the way that tabletop game works, again, not, I have limited experience. So, but is that like everyone has pretty conflicting motives in that. Like a lot of times you're bound together by necessity.
Yeah.
But people tend to have their own subplots they want to get out. The World of Darkness system encourages that.
Yeah.
You having like kind of an overarching goal for your character, like wanting to create a character arc for yourself, which is difficult when a human person has to balance that.
Yeah.
Like spotlight time. Like there are GMs who are good and can do that, but that's hard.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And in a computer, you're always going to prioritize, like you might be very interested in Glory's story. At the same time, you're making all your decisions for your character, and that's the thrust of the game. Like Glory's story is 5% of the game.
Yeah.
It's very memorable. It's great. I love it. Wouldn't trade it for anything, but it's a part of the whole.
Mm-hmm.
Because you're the main character is the one getting the attention. Like it's a question of focus.
Yeah.
With that.
I didn't realize that the vampire, so it's Vampire Redemption. I think I said Requiem before, but that's a different thing. I didn't realize that their next game was Marvel, that team's name.
The Rise of the Imperfects?
Rise of the Imperfects, yeah. Same studio.
The kids got to learn about the Rise of the Imperfects someday. I think about the Imperfects all the time.
Do you?
And like what we're going to do when they rise. It's going to be fucked up.
Nobody's ready for this. Nobody listens to me about the Imperfects.
There's climate change and there's the Imperfects. And there's like two things we had to watch out for. And we are on a serious clock with both of them. It's just kind of a different consideration. I think one of the things that also throws this question that makes it interesting is that like Baldur's Gate 3 is a real outlier in many ways.
Yeah.
And one of the ways is that it does feel like it basically gives everybody equal time. Mm-hmm. And it does that through really good writing and being really long.
Yeah.
And it still doesn't give everyone equal time. Like Will's story is not as complicated as like everyone else's, but most of the characters get equal time. It's the closest thing I think we've had to a good GM giving every character a main character arc.
Yes.
In a video game. And I think that the answer, it's maybe simpler than we're even kind of moving around is that it's super fucking hard.
Yeah. It's rare. You know? It's rare for a reason, right?
Yeah. Lots of money and lots of time goes into that.
Neither of which are cheap.
Yeah. But much more easy to have a cipher and characters have one quest and then they're done.
Yeah.
You have a loyalty quest that's over, or just not have that at all. Have your main character and then just have the world be the thing you interact with.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't know that I have anything else.
No. Yeah. Thank you, Kerr.
Thank you.
Yeah. We're going to read some responses to September's games. If you, thanks everybody for writing in. Those games were Majora's Mask, Against the Storm, and Outer Wilds, Echo of the Eye. Mm-hmm. It looks like you have Echo of the Eye last for spoiler reasons. No.
I just moved it. I'm going to put it last for spoiler reasons. When we get to that, just if you want to just skip ahead and then, to like 5 minutes before the episode ends.
Yeah. Yeah. Let's read some stuff out. What does Zane say?
Zane says, I have never found a better alarm ringtone than the Clocktown theme, talking about Majora's Mask. If you have trouble getting yourself up in the morning, it's just the right combination of unsettling and earwormy. You can even use the second and third day themes for multiple alarms of increasing anxiety.
That's really fun.
It's very fun. Yeah. Good idea.
Mm-hmm. It's up there with like Sonic Browning music.
Oh God, why would you do that to yourself?
Because you want to wake up.
Yeah.
Because you want to panic. Alex says, a quick shout out regarding ways to play Majora's in the current year. The Zelda 64 recompiled project has the game running natively on PC and Steam Deck with mod support, gyro aim, autosaves, and tons more. Just want to throw them a shout out if anyone wants to revisit the game after listening to the episode. Loved hearing Bob guest host on this one. Cheers.
Thank you. Yeah, thanks. Big thanks to Bob for stepping in on that one again.
Yeah, thanks,
Bob. Yeah, especially thanks from Gary.
I got to chill out. It was awesome. Yeah. Thank you, Bob.
Nice. So we dedicated some time on the episode to talking about the differences between the N64 version you can play on Switch now and the 3DS one. Ultimately, I went with the 3DS. I might have made a different decision if I knew about this mod. So thank you.
Yeah.
Andrew writes, hi there. My husband Ed sponsored the Majora's Mask episode for me as a Christmas present, and I'm very grateful to him. This game came out when I was 11, a potent time to confront something so weird and sad. It's probably its fault that I still mainly engage with media to find moments that haunt me in a good way and add them to my mental scrapbook. Emergence into the Astral Observatory has pride of place on my eerie celestial page, next to Elevator Descent Underground in Elden Ring, Planetarium Monologue, and I Saw the TV Glow, and Mountain Dew Baja Midnight. Thanks for your wonderful show. Thank you. Thank you to you, Andrew, and to Ed.
Yeah. And happy birthday. Or Merry Christmas, rather.
Merry Christmas. Getting it in early.
I'm just getting in early for birthday.
Yeah.
Yeah. Steven writes in, howdy y'all. When I heard you were covering Majora's Mask, I had to write in. Majora's Mask is probably the game that influenced me the most growing up. Seeing all of my favorite Ocarina of Time characters in a new dark world was creepy and unsettling, but the theme of helping people really stuck with me. My video game power fantasy is helping people. So when credits roll and the butler is shown weeping over his son, the catalyst for you to receive the Deku Mask, I just about lost it. The butler's son is the only character who you see and then are locked away from for the entire game until credits. A powerful reminder that you can't save everyone. Are there any games that you have that have shaped you the way you are or had a message that still impacts you today? Thank you for everything you do.
I don't know.
Sure.
Shape? Yeah.
Like, I think about all kinds of stuff that's very resonant with me. I'm looking at my Disco Elysium. There's still time.
Yeah.
I knew that, but it's just a reminder.
Mm-hmm.
That's nice.
It's a really poignant expression of it that you don't see in video games. Games do not concern themselves with that.
Yeah, it's not so much about learning the thing. It's more about just being reminded. I think about that. I think about, I think about Torment all the time. Mm-hmm. That you are not the self you were from yesterday.
Yeah.
There's kind of a theme in these things, mm-hmm. but like the idea of the past being infinite and a little bit unknowable and feeling estranged from the person you were before is something that's very resonant with me. And then the logical, hopeful conclusion of that, of like, you don't have to be that person.
Yeah.
You know,
it's hard for me to get into this without landing on like, oh, this is a game, like this game found me at exactly the right time to really influence my aesthetics. You know, like I just, all of my preferences basically are, this was really cool when I found it, you know, or derivations of that, some, you know, somehow. So like, I don't know if I don't, if that friend's parent doesn't rent Silent Hill for us, and freak me the fuck out when I was too young to play it, what am I doing now? I don't know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No rusty material, machinery.
Mm-hmm.
I know, right? No rusted fences.
Yeah, that's awesome. I mean, my house is surrounded by a rusted fence. It's great.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. It's living in Silent Hill.
Mm-hmm. Heaven. Spencer writes, happy time loop month. That was not intentional, but it's very funny.
It just happened, yeah.
Yeah. I think Majora's Mask makes a much more interesting item randomizer than most Zelda games because of how its dungeons were designed for the fact that you may need to leave and come back midway through. Thanks, schedule system. Because of that, they filled the dungeon with shortcuts that you can take advantage of when you come in with items that you wouldn't normally have at that point in the game. It is incredibly satisfying to figure out how to navigate Snowhead Temple and even get all of the stray fairies without any of the small keys, but with fire arrows and the hookshot. Real shame about the Great Bay Temple, though. As always, the water dungeon is the worst. The only benefit of a randomizer there is that you can probably get away with not fighting that god-awful eye mini-boss. P.S. Getting the urge to do another run is how I recognize the onset of burnout now. Majora's Mask is my fairy in the coal mine. Yeah, no. I don't feel that for Majora's Mask. I love that though. Like just I made a post a couple weeks back, but it's like me getting the urge to load up the Sims is the equivalent of the elves just dreaming of that one shore.
Yeah.
In Lord of the Rings.
Like, yeah, emergency. Like I've talked about the Sims that way forever, like as a meritocracy simulator when I'm depressed.
Yeah. For me specifically, it's about moving. It's like, oh my God, my feet are getting itchy.
Yep. Yeah. I'm so glad I don't remember the specifics of that dungeon. I don't really drink anymore, but I'm gonna buy Baba beer. Just be like, buddy, I didn't have to replay that dungeon and this mini boss I forgot about. I'm just remembering the atmosphere of this game. I didn't do it again. Mm-hmm. Fucking owns. Thank you. Thank you, brother. Yeah. Is that, which one is that? It's the water one, but like, what is odious about that dungeon?
So that is, instead of being water levels, you're manipulating water flow. So like, you get to different areas, based on if the water is flowing clockwise or counterclockwise through it.
Okay.
Yeah.
Got you. Yeah. I have vague memories of that.
Yeah. And that boss it's a mini boss, and it's just that Zelda concept where you're fighting a big thing covered with other things. You have to pull off the small things and get rid of them to expose the weak spot.
Ah, yeah. They love that well.
Yeah, they do.
Yeah. Gordon says, hiya. I've just been playing through Majora's Mask for what must be my fifth time, thanks to my kids getting really excited about the Zelda series. After this many replays and the added utility of Switch save states, the clunk of the controls fades away to leave one of the greatest game worlds ever conceived. The kids are massive fans of Adventure Time, so the blend of kid-safe but adult-disturbing horror was a big draw for them. They keep making me stop to turn and stare at the moon. I'm not allowed to skip any mask transformations, and Tingle needs to get shot down every time we see him. And I realize that's exactly how I played the game on my first playthrough 25 years ago, and I spawned a second generation of morbid little goblins. I guess time really is a flat circle, but more importantly, the good art that went into this game is eternal.
That is a very cute story, and I love that you have, like, passed that taste forward. You know, kids do not, and often do not always, reflect the taste of their parents. Usually they rebel against it, but in this case, because I like those things that you're giving them, I think it's good that this is happening.
Mm-hmm. Teaching kids to distrust a tingle is good.
Yeah. You got to expose them early.
If you should meet a tingle in the road, like it is, it's not good.
Yeah. We had so many responses about Majora's Mask. Obviously we have to, you know, be a little bit selective about that, but thank you for writing in, everybody, with your stories.
I appreciate it. Mm-hmm. Moving on to Against the Storm. Again, we're doing Outer Wilds, Shadows of the Eye, Echoes of the Eye later, because it's a spoilery.
Yeah. Zane writes, I really wanted to like Against the Storm, but it never quite clicked. I felt like I had too little control over events with big impacts, like where events showed up and what they would be, and too much control over things that didn't seem to matter, like types of resources that all seemed to do the same thing. I tried turning off the timer, but that just made the game take longer and made me second-guess myself more, without giving me the context that I needed to make informed decisions. The first few sessions weren't hard, but I didn't feel like I was learning or getting better, so I had to put it down. I'm hoping that your episode gives me some insights that I missed, so I can give it another try.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I get it. I liked this game a lot. It took me a little while to get into, too. This is, mm-hmm. I think those are things that are just kind of part of the crafty game, like the seeing just tons of resources that don't matter, like except in this game they cannot matter because of the randomized things you get.
Mm-hmm.
It's counterintuitive to have a game give you chaff.
Yeah,
you know, like usually the law of conservation of detail means that like if a game is giving me something, I think it's important.
Mm-hmm.
Getting over that is tough.
Yeah. I think something we hit in the episode is that like the fact that most of the resources you get ultimately end up doing the same thing, it is a part of figuring out how to work within limitations of the randomization. So maybe if you go back with that in mind, it might click more. Also, it is a weird ass decision that they made in making the game, in a game full of, you know, that is based on a very weird decision. So like, I don't blame anybody for it not hitting right.
Yeah. It's got a weird kind of chimera quality to it.
Yeah.
No. And also the fact that the tutorial is 4 hours long. Like you did the first couple games, like getting to the point where you offboarded takes longer than it takes most games to get to an offboarding or even onboarding point.
Yeah.
Like it is a very slow start in this game.
Mm-hmm.
Chris says, Against the Storm would have been my game of the year for 2024, if not for Balatro. I was so glad to hear you decided to take the plunge. Just prior to the first DLC release, I was fortunate to catch a live Q&A with the devs. They were super friendly, answering questions that they could, and excitedly showing off the new environment and features that they were adding to the game. My question was about the size of the team, as their Discord profile said there were just 5 people. They chuckled as they revealed they had grown slightly and were now just a team of 6. I'm blown away by the polish and tightness of the system from such a small team. The level of detail in the art and sound design impressed me as much as the gameplay loop gripped me. I'm here to see what Aramite Games puts out next.
Yeah.
Yeah. Agreed. By any means or any measure, very mm-hmm. impressive.
Yes. Yeah. Team size discourse is popping up because of Silk Song and whatever. Ah. Oftentimes it bubbles up. But like, you know, it's not especially annoying, but it's just like it gets down to oftentimes the narrative about a game is like, oh, this was this huge achievement was made by a startlingly small number of people so these big games with big teams, what excuse do they have? And oftentimes when you hear those small things, when that small team size is marketed as such, it's like, oh, it was 3 core people plus hundreds of contractors.
Yeah.
Right. You know? And I'm amenable to the idea that contractors should be counted as devs on a thing.
Agreed.
So, yeah.
Yeah. As long as Silk Song doesn't bring up a difficulty discourse, I'm okay.
Like, oh my God, Jesus Christ,
I assume that one was dead and like the, and we solved it. And I'm just assuming, since I'm not online, that we've all gotten over it and Silk Song has not brought that up.
Like, the difficulty is worth talking about, but I don't know that there's a discourse. God, any of the.
No. There's that. I'm being sarcastic. There's a huge discourse around it. Like,
I know. It's just exhausting. It makes me want to go to sleep.
Yeah, it sucks. It sucks so fucking bad.
It's that is a game that I am playing and enjoying and irritated by some of the difficulty decisions they made.
Yeah. You haven't logged on to see whether you're good or bad because of that.
No, I haven't.
You are maybe good or you are maybe bad because you're irritated by some of those decisions. It's either respect artistic vision,
mm-hmm.
you know, or devs are ableist and there's just no point in between. Those are the two things.
And I'm existing in this like superposition of these two states. I am simultaneously good and bad, and Garriott's ripping me fucking apart.
Yeah, it's a great reason to log off. That stuff, nobody in real life will ever talk to you like that.
No, awesome. never, like ever. I've talked about Silk Song on a podcast with my friends.
Yeah, it's exactly, it's that TikTok of like, just like, what are you ordering at Buffalo Wild Wings? Like, you can come hang out, but like, don't talk about shit like that. It's weird.
Yeah.
You know, we're all trying to get Rob to take his shirt off. Like, you know, this is the point. It's not a distraction. We're doing it. You can hang out, but don't fucking be weird.
Don't talk about wanting $1 billion, dude.
Yeah, what are you even ordering from Buffalo Wild Wings? Like, right? That's like,
that's a very good video.
It's really well observed. Like, that is, if people don't know what we're talking about, that leaked through my filters and stuff. And I'm like, oh, this is actually wholesome and good.
Yeah.
We're going to do Echoes of the Eye stuff. There might be a little spoilers in this. Mm-hmm. Skip forward, like, I don't know, 10 minutes. Yeah. Maybe a little less. Don't know exactly how much.
Yeah.
But Gordon says, I firmly believe Outer Wilds is the greatest adventure game ever made, so I was more than excited for Echoes. However, I had a new baby and could only play for maybe an hour once a week. Let me tell you, realizing that you'd made literally zero progress during your weekly allocation was brutal, especially when a significant amount of time was spent just getting back to where you needed to poke about. The limitations of the time loop game system certainly started to show for the DLC, and yes, the stealth sequences are just a mistake. Despite these weaknesses, I don't think anything has ever given me that sense of emotional whiplash as when I managed to get out of the spooky dark docks of the Stranger and immediately being launched into the wacky wild water rafting adventure. And I'll forever love Echoes of the Eye as a result. It's also given me an all-time favorite Adventure Time solution. Spoiler warning, can't wake up if you're dead. Yeah. Yep, true.
Yeah. I can't take that away from you. Outer Wilds.
It's true.
Oh man, that's funny. And I feel bad for not dining on that moment very much when you just burst out and it's like banjo.
It's very funny.
It's Banjo Time's river you're journey.
Tubing. All of a sudden, like you've gone tubing. Shit, I'm tubing.
Oh man, Ivan writes, "Hi there. Thanks for the awesome coverage. For me, Outer Wilds is a perfect Star Trek game. There are some Star Trek games that are about ship combat, but the show is never about combat. It is about curiosity and exploration, which Outer Wilds managed to gamify perfectly. Of course, Star Trek is also about diplomacy, empathy, and humanity, but that is even harder to gamify. Do you remember any other games that adapted some media so well, just without a license or unintentionally?"
Yeah. What was the thing? This was a movie. It wasn't a game, but thinking about how much The Mummy is like a Call of Cthulhu.
Oh yeah.
Tabletop campaign reminds mm-hmm. me of that a little bit.
Yeah. I was just thinking about that point, like Unbidden earlier today. That was a very good poll when we were recording that episode. That is not this show.
Warm and trenchant. that's me. Warm and trenchant. Now,
I can't think of anything off the top of my head that is like a perfect serial numbers filed off adaptation like that.
Yeah. It's interesting to think about, like, I have a close relationship with Star Trek, at least the Next Generation, and then a little bit Deep Space Nine. And my primary thought for Star Trek is utopian morality.
Yeah.
You know, and it's interesting to compare Outer Wilds to that because morality is where I feel like it falls down. Like, I don't agree with the morals of this universe. Mm-hmm. Generally, and to me, the thing I like about Star Trek is that it is, what if we were better? Mm-hmm. You know, it has an exploration angle to it, but it's not just exploration for the, you know, the virtue of exploration. It's like, once you get there, let's show you a morality play that teaches you how to be.
Yeah.
You know, is the thing I love about Star Trek. So it's an interesting thought. Like, mm-hmm. it might be that I am viewing Star Trek wrong or differently as well.
Yeah.
But, you know. Cinderelf says, I really have or make the time to play along with the podcast, usually listening to it as a service. When I heard you were covering the DLC I never got around to for a game I loved playing a few years ago, I sat all other plans on hold to get through it. This game would fit in right with the October lineup for me because there's a long time since I felt this scared playing a game. Sure, I got a light chuckle out of the first time an alien grabbed me and it looked like he was going to bite my face off, only for it to gently blow out my lantern and boot me from the simulation. But knowing that was the only punishment for getting caught somehow didn't diminish the horror I felt sneaking around them. I'm also very impressed with how, with the now even bigger scale of the solar system in the game. All those timed events of the main game are still taking place while you're on the Stranger. And even inside the simulation, you're sneaking away from the Owlks at the same time as Brittle Hollow is falling apart and sand is being transferred from one ash twin to another. And I think that is amazing.
Yeah.
Yeah. Time continues while you're in the DLC.
Agreed. It's where scale gets, it gets really weird with like,
yeah,
it's impossible because there's no real point of reference. And because the planets are all so small and close together, like I do not have a reckon on how much bigger the Stranger is in absolute terms than, you know, name another planet. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. It's also those things generally, since the DLC doesn't interact with the main game, mm-hmm. in a way, like it's interesting, like just you kind of know those things are still going on, but you never have to like, you know, wait for this event in the Stranger and then go deal with this event in the Ash Twin.
Yeah.
Or anything like that. Like they don't interface. And I know that's not a criticism. It'd be ridiculous.
Yeah. I don't know if I would like that. Yeah.
Yeah. I wouldn't like it. And it's a lot to ask, but like you do have to kind of keep in mind like, oh yeah, that's still happening.
Yeah.
Yeah. Hmm. Yeah. What does Fenrelliania say?
Fenrelliania here says, having sponsored the original Outer Wilds is a decision that still gives me joy and satisfaction when I remember it. The person I was at the time is nearly unrecognizable to who I am now, in many ways for the better, but not without a lot of tribulation and trauma. Now I have seen the ways that game, one of my favorites, has informed your discussions in the years since and opened up a possibility for you to experience Echoes of the Eye. It's silly and not that similar, but it parallels, but the parallels to The Prisoner make me smile. From trailer to finale, Echoes of the Eye's tone captured me, but it took a lot of talking and processing before I appreciated what it did for the story. I could gush for paragraphs, but more than anything, I read so much heart and hope into the way one person stepped out to do what they felt was right. In the moment, they achieved very little, just briefly letting out the message from the eye. But that small act had an impact on someone far away, who also seemed to fail to achieve anything important, but who set up the opportunities for people far in the future to achieve something so important. We likely never know the breadth of our impact in life, but being able to show The Prisoner the impact that they had, that idea kept me going through many tough years.
Yeah, well said.
Yeah, I like that.
Yeah.
Even if it is impossible to look at what The Prisoner did as good unless things worked out so specifically well.
Yeah, it still feels, you know, you've heard the episode, I assume. Like, yeah. It still feels solved backwards for success to me.
Yeah.
A little bit in the actual game. Like, I think that is a very sweet, like, that idea is awesome. And there's a way to do that with different circumstances.
The sheer improbability and the scale of time works with that. But also it is hard to read a human value into that other than, you know, taken in microcosm. This is, you know, kind of like a sliding doors crash kind of thing, right?
Human value, and again, we talked about this in the episode, but being a little bit unmotivated on behalf of the prisoner to just kind of be like, I don't know, maybe it's good.
Yeah.
And then just be like, I got a feeling it's good. And then just being right, you know.
If we just knew more, if the prisoner's presence in the story was more than just, hey, one of these Owlks has one horn.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah.
But it would be weird with the scale of time for them to know what the thing was. Like, you could have done it as a Cassandra Truth, and it would have been... It would have made more sense to me as a story.
Yeah.
But it would have required, you know, that's really hard to do with them not using written language. You have to,
also it takes away like the power of the reveal. Right.
Yeah. You know, so I understand why it is the way it is, but it's one of the things that for me puts up a barrier, but it's just me and the devs. Like the devs of this game, the writers of it have a different attitude towards humanity and exploration and science than I do.
Mm-hmm.
Like they just have a different moral valence with it as a virtue in and of itself that I just can't share.
Right.
You know, which is okay. And I have no feelings for anybody who does share that. I'm glad that like people get stuff out of it because people really do.
They do. You know,
these games are a religious experience to some people and good.
Yeah.
You know, that's excellent.
All the better.
But I feel different. Mm-hmm. So let's announce what we're doing in November. We'll be gone until November.
Yes. So, if you have thoughts about October's games, You can write in at duckfeed.tv/contact. Those are Mouthwashing, the Silent Hill 2 remake, Cryptmaster, and the premium episode that month is Fear. Your typing is distracting me. Don't do it. No.
Focus. Lock in.
Sorry, geez. It's been a rough week. November, the deadline is the 15th. And Gary, what are those games?
We are starting off with a sponsored episode on Monster Train 2.
Mm-hmm.
Very exciting. Funny thing, I put my hundreds and hundreds of hours into that, and now they updated it in a cool way.
Okay.
The DLC has not come out, but so now I have to keep, you know, I have to play it more, which is no bad
thing. Twist your arm.
Yeah. Twist my arm. But very excited to talk about Monster Train 2, my game of the year.
Mm-hmm.
After that is a K-pick.
Yeah.
Unpacking.
Unpacking. We're going to dip our toes into cozy games a little bit. I think this game is super neat. It tells its story in a way that I really enjoy, the kind of the personal archaeology kind of thing. And it doesn't seem like it, but it is telling a story. It's cool. I'm happy to bring it to the show, even if it's not going to be like a super long episode.
Yeah. We do short games sometimes where, yeah. You know, next week is Mouthwashing. Mm-hmm. And then after that, our premium episode, another sponsored episode is Hitman Blood Money.
Yeah.
I'm very excited for that. I love the Hitman games, even if they are not, the older ones are not as streamlined.
Uh-huh.
As the new ones, I just want more Hitman.
Yeah.
I will play the less streamlined Hitman to get more Hitman.
Blood Money was the biggest leap to Hitman 2016 that happened prior to Hitman 2016, right?
Yeah, the biggest, like the biggest leap that happened since or before.
Yes. Yeah.
Rather. Yeah. Like it's closer to a modern game than the previous ones.
Yes.
Yeah. Very excited for that.
Mm-hmm.
Looking forward to doing it. I haven't spent time with the old Hitman games, really. And I love my boy.
I would like to see the previous adventures of my boy.
Yeah. There are only games with 47 in them. They're the only movies with Creep in them. You gotta watch them.
Like, gotta watch Creep.
You get 47, you know?
Uh-huh.
Love 47. After that's going to be our winter RPG, as per usual. Mm-hmm. So like a largely month-long affair. We're going to announce that next dispatch. You know, if you're listening to this, we appreciate you. If you want to hear those premium episodes, so our episode on Fear and our episode on Hitman Blood Money, and our recent episode on Against the Storm, join us on Patreon. Go to patreon.com/duckfeedtv. $5 a month gets you that shit.
It does. It also gets you the ability to submit questions and topics for the dispatch episodes.
Mm-hmm. Which we think is fun, and we think you'll think is fun.
Yeah.
You can also leave us range reviews on Apple Podcasts, Podcast Addict, anywhere you find podcasts.
Mm-hmm. Leave comments on the Spotify episodes.
Yeah, we appreciate that. Tell your friends, spread the word, write about us on message boards and stuff. We'd appreciate that. Check out the archives.
Yeah.
Let's say you're somebody who likes the Venture Brothers. We have a whole Venture Brothers show. We go through the whole fucking thing.
We have a whole show and they're all in one place now. You can just click the podcast tab on Patreon and see all of them. The free ones and the paid ones all in one place. It's a lot.
Yeah. Do it. Big thanks to Gwen, our producer.
Thank you, Gwen.
Yeah. And I think that's about it.
I think so. We'll see you next week with Mouthwashing.
Yeah. Better wash your mouth if you must.
Mm.